Well, welcome to the show, everyone. This is episode number 33. Sweet. So episode number 33, and this is my friend Chester. Chester is a stud. We've been working on this deal for probably a good month and a half, maybe 2 months, trying to get Chester here, trying to make it connect, and we finally made it happen. So Chester, welcome to the show. Look forward to this one for a long time. So welcome.
Dude, thank you. Glad to be here. Glad we finally were able to ink a deal.
We did to get me on here, man. Yeah. So there's going to be a ton to talk about today. Like, you have a very successful company. You and I, like, we're in the same state, but we're different parts of the area, and we've been racing each other for a long time. I went backwards, and now I'm trying to catch back up. You keep plugging forward, and you're knocking out of the park, and it's been fun to watch you grow for sure.
You're one of my closest buddies, man.
Yeah.
It's always great to catch up and connect, and we always end up talking about something that we find interesting anyway. So
for sure. And whether it's the middle of winter talking about snow or middle of summer talking about lawn care, landscaping, which looks like you got into some hardscaping recently, so we can start talking about that. There's a lot of stuff to talk about. I know you at one point were subbing most of your fertilization weed control out, brought that in-house. But before we get started on all this, why don't you just kind of tell us your background, how you started, how you got in the industry. Tell them how you started the company, you know, and you weren't working in the company at all. You were actually a crane operator, if I'm correct. You did that for a few years and you weren't even at the company. So kind of just walk us through the story of how it began, and then where you started, and then where you guys are at today.
Cool. Okay. So I, normal upbringing, whatever, Midwest upbringing, had a few entrepreneurial shots I took in high school. It didn't go too far. After high school, I went to college for 2 days and found out that wasn't really my gig. So then I just went to work, started working, had 3 jobs at one time. So I was working in a manufacturing facility. I was delivering after the morning shift, I would go deliver pizzas. And then at night, I got a job with a snow removal company. And when it snowed after my pizza shift, I'd go shovel snow and then wake up in the morning and go work in the manufacturing facility again. And then the snow guy asked me if I'd come on full time in the spring. So that's when I got my first exposure to lawn and landscape industry. I was like 19 years old and got exposed to a pretty solid company, mid-sized company. And I worked there for about 4 years. I saw a lot that I thought I would do differently and never really had a voice to do much there other than run a crew, run a rig. But I was a good employee and learned a lot while I was there. Then I tested into an apprenticeship program as an operating engineer, and I became a crane operator. And I always thought about that business, man. I always thought about getting into the lawn and landscape business. So what I did then, I did exactly what Taylor Hansen did. Mm-hmm. He mentioned this on your last episode. He goes, yeah, well, I went in YouTube and typed in how to start a lawn care business. And I found a bunch of information. Who did I find? I found Jonathan Potoshnik. that's how it was born. You know, it's the traditional lawnmower in the backyard with a beat up pickup truck and just out there hustling. So that was that's how we got off the ground. I kept that job for like 4 years. I kept my day job as a crane operator. And I think because I just didn't have the confidence that I could actually make it work. So kept working my day job and kept growing the company. And now here we are today, doing really well.
Yeah. So I remember you were telling me during that transition phase, like I need to get my company to this size, which I think back then is like $1 million, so you could cover your payroll expense for yourself to could jump on board, right? I think it was like $100,000 at that time. Am I correct? 80, 100 grand somewhere in there.
Yeah, I was making $100,000 as a crane operator,
yeah,
give or take. You know, you get to make a lot of money with the overtime. So I had some 6-figure years there. And yeah, I remember you kind of being instrumental in that, dude. You're like the most confident person in the world. So I'm sure we had many of these conversations. And that was kind of my number. I thought if I can get to $1 million, $1.5 million, I could probably afford to replace my salary. But I was saving so much money anyway. I mean, I'm a bachelor, you know, I was getting by on $30,000-$40,000 a year. Yeah. So I think it was more of this. It was that golden handcuffs of the middle class, like pension. You have benefits. Well, what about the benefits? You know, it was they had the golden handcuffs on me, but I knew I just didn't want to do that for the rest of my life.
Yeah. So what made you finally pull the plug? I know we had a lot of conversations around that. Like, when are you going to do it? How are you going to do it? But what was the final thing that's like, okay, I can do this. Like, I'm just going to go do it. The company is probably at 1 point something around that time, right?
Yeah, we did one. The year I left, we did 1.5. So there's two things I can remember. One is that when I got into the construction world, I got the dream career, right? Pretty good blue collar career. I could look ahead and I could look at guys that were in their 40s or their 50s. And I could say, like, if I come in here every day and I do this, that's where I could hope to end up. You can kind of see, like, where would I end up if I were to pursue this career more? I could be a job site superintendent or whatever. There's money to be made, but I could look ahead and see, okay, could be me when I'm 50, right?
Yeah.
And then I got involved in entrepreneurship a little bit, and I saw guys that were in their 40s and 50s that had taken the path of entrepreneurship. And I could basically decide, well, do I want to be that guy or do I want to be this guy? And to me, it looked like a more appealing outcome to take the path of entrepreneurship. So that was one moment I remember where I was like, wow, you know, these guys I'm looking at, they're overweight, their bodies beat to hell.
Yep.
They've been, you know, they're making the same money I'm making. They're working just as much. They have no real, they have a pension and stuff, but it's not like you're really building an asset. And yeah. I just didn't want to land there. So that was number one. And then number two, when I really just made sense of the economics, was when I was doing price increases. So I sat down one day on a Sunday and I was doing price increases for the business. And it wasn't a very streamlined process. It was kind of tedious, but basically I could go into one of my accounts and I could say, hey, Jonas, you're going to, you know, we have to do a 10% price increase on your account this year. And I've mail them a letter and do the whole shebang. And I could do one every 10 minutes or whatever. I found out that, like, I'm kind of, you know, pulling from my memory here, but it was like every price increase I did made me like $200 or something, or $300. And I went, well, dude, if I do 20 of these a day, that's like $6,000. So I'm like, if I just quit my job and get a full-time job at Big Lakes doing price increases on all my accounts, I can make $6,000 a day. So that was like, I finally had proof of ROI on my time, because you know what it's like being a business owner. Sometimes you work at 100-hour week and you're like, we lost money, right? Or what did I even, it's a less clear, tangible connection between your time and your money. It's no longer about that. So coming from a middle-class upbringing, that was where I was like, well, here's a way I can rationalize selling my time for a higher dollar figure. And I took the leap.
That's awesome. A very good analogy too. You brought up a few things and I got to go back to your question, but price increases. So many people are afraid to do a price increase. How many times have you and I both seen this across the board over the last 10 years? People are just so afraid to raise prices.
Mm-hmm.
And how much, possibly. Right. But how much put, because they're like, oh, I'm going to lose a bunch of customers, right? But in reality, when you have a price increase, how much pushback do you usually get?
Yeah, I mean,
none.
A blip on the radar.
Right. Even like, and we're always taught, like, okay, cool. If you increase your revenue, increase your prices by 50%, right? And you're going to lose half your customers, you're still doing the same amount of work. Same amount of revenue with half the people.
Mm-hmm.
And people just they get so afraid to raise prices. But anyway, I just want to throw that out there real quick. Going back to like making the transition from being a craner operator and jumping into the business, people have a hard enough time starting a business, being there every single day, right? Like being involved constantly, but you weren't involved. I mean, you were involved, of course, but you weren't physically doing the work almost from day one. You had a full-time job. How did you manage your operations? How did you manage the mowing and all that stuff? Why you had a full-time job? And it's probably actually a really good thing. We've talked about this. Like, you weren't able to be there. You didn't get sucked in. You could see the bird's eye view for almost the entire time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was a really good exercise. It forced me to build layers of management because guys that are at the company every day, they're the bandage, right? Like, I didn't show up, so now I'm going to go jump on the crew and do work, or the truck won't. Well, now I'm going to crawl under there and fix it, you know?
Yeah.
Which is good. And that's commendable. And that's what you got to do to get a business going. But when you're forced to not be able to be the bandage, you need to be a little more, maybe sophisticated in the way that you build the thing, right? And so it certainly wasn't without its challenges and headaches, but it kind of just trained me to build systems for when a guy doesn't show up, what do we do, right? Because I'm at work. Or when the truck doesn't start, how do we manage that issue? So it forced me to build more of a business and less of a job. And it was good exercise. And then, of course, it allowed me to not take any money out of the company so we could, reinvest quicker. It's like we weren't putting the money back into the company. We just weren't taking any out to begin with.
It's the same story as all of us.
Yeah, all of us. Yeah. And it's kind of like a badge of honor. Like, I didn't get a paycheck for 5 years. And it kind of, there's pros and cons to that,
Oh, for sure. And there's another common theme that I see in the podcast over and over and over again. It's the same thing. Like, yep, didn't take a paycheck for the first 5 years, but it was massive action too. Like, everyone, like yourself, like, you're an absolute beast. You're always on the go. You're always moving. You're always doing something. But it's that massive action over and over and over again that just, it makes you scale so much faster. People are like, well, how do you get more work? You're not going to sit behind a computer and hope for more work. You just got to go actively pursue it all the time. And you're just one of those guys. Like, you're proven over and over and over again. You're the 10X model, right? It's constantly going.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And you are too, man. It's like a game. It's a game of will.
Yeah.
It's not a game of intellect necessarily. You know what I mean? Yeah. Especially now in an age where information is universally available.
Yeah.
It's like the new separator is hard work again.
For sure. And so, like, going back to when we first started out, like, we didn't have all that information. It was just starting to get there, right? The information was just coming on, like, on the internet, on the YouTube. It was just starting out. Like, so I say to all the kids I talk to now, like, if I had what you had, I could do it 10 times faster too. So go do it. But like you said, it's not intellect now. Now it's like, you can only watch so many videos. You can only read so many books, right? But at the end of the day, you have to put the shit to work. Otherwise, you're wasting your time.
Mm-hmm. That's exactly what it is. Yeah. It's like, grab some information, go implement.
Yep.
Grab more information, implement, right? It's all about doing it.
Yeah, for sure. So now it's 2023, Big Lake Lawn Care. I don't know where you guys ended last year, but you're like round five, right? If I remember. Mm-hmm.
Round five.
Yeah, what is your projections for 2023?
We should land north of six this year.
That's what I figured.
Cool. We're taking a year to, which I never thought I'd say, but we're actually like taking a year to try to optimize a little bit. I heard somebody say, like, don't reinvent the wheel, just make the wheel run a little smoother. Yeah. Right. So that's kind of what we're trying to do. We're not doing any crazy disruptive new additions to the business. We're just optimizing, but we're growing, like, we're blowing all our sales targets out of the water too. Yeah. So it's been a great season for us thus far.
That's
so
awesome.
We should crack six, no problem.
That's really cool. So I know, like, you started out in mowing, and then you got into snow removal. Then you had your FERT for a long time, got it subbed out, and then you recently brought that in house. What did that look like to sub it out? What were you? What did that look like? Just so all the listeners can maybe learn something here. Like, when you're subbing out your FERT, how much were you charging the client and how much were you charging the person who's actually doing the work? Like, what was that split right there?
I think we were taking 20 to 30% of what we were collecting from the client we were keeping. So that'd be like 30% gross margin.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Which is kind of funny. I had a call with this guy. He kind of mentored me for a while. He was doing like 10 or 12 million and, I was sort of like lamenting about my margins. I'm like, our margins are in the tank, we're having a hard time making money and stuff. We're just growing. It happens. But he goes, do you do fertilization? And I'm like, yeah, we actually just sub it out, trying to keep the business real simple. And he goes, okay, do you do irrigation? And I said, no, we sub that out too. And he goes, so you subcontract the two most profitable niches in this industry, right? And you're keeping all the junk. And, he's like, why don't you think about, go stew on that for a while and then think about your margins again, right? So it's funny to think about, but I do think there's a lot of merit to keeping the business simple in the early years and subbing a lot of those things out to a good reputable provider and just making sure that you budget for the fact that if you're going to have a 30% gross margin, there's not much overhead available for you to support that, right? Yeah,
yep, for sure.
It allows you to build a book of business and it allows you to, capture the client and keep control of that relationship. I would say too, though, it's really important to be transparent with the person you're subbing to, because if you got, if you're subbing out 200K or 300K in FERT, and then you yank out the rug from them and bring it in house, that could really sour a relationship if you didn't tell them about it up front.
Yeah, I agree. And that was my two next questions were, okay, how much work were you subbing out the time? So I'm going to guess between 200,000 to 300,000, I'm assuming. And then when you pulled the plug on the guy, what was that like? I'm sure it's hard for both parties, but it's a tough conversation to have in business. But what did that look like?
Yeah, tough conversation. They knew it. They knew it in advance. Okay. You know, I told them, hey, this is, I eventually intend to bring this in house, and they were gracious enough to, you know, be okay with that. So I think we were probably around 200K, 300, 250, somewhere we could support a technician.
Yeah.
And then what I did is I hired a guy who was an old Scotts guy. He ran like a Scotts lawn care branch back in the day before they got acquired, and just industry of that, you know what I mean? And I brought him in and I was like, hey, dude, I need to bring the fertilization in-house. I need somebody to design the program, teach us how to manage the inventory and handle the whole product part, the legality part, licensure. And then I also need you to be like a working applicator for the first 6 months or so. And we did it in I hired the guy in like November, December. So we had plenty of ramp time. And then we just blew it out of the frickin' water that spring with sales. And I got him, he was in the field for like, you know, not at all, barely. I mean, he was in the field for a couple of weeks. We hired an applicator, hired a second applicator, and things took off. But, you know, another positive angle to doing it that way, where you sub it in the beginning, is that your office, you learn how to sell it, you learn how to bill it and speak the language and like manage the administrative side of it. Then you just need to bring in the technicians when you're ready.
Yeah, that's awesome. Very smart. So you have a lot going on. Like I said, you're doing hardscaping for these weed control, mowing, snow plowing. That's a lot, right? You have a lot of moving parts. Couple questions around that. How many people do you have in the office for your $5 million business like that?
I have eight-ish.
Yeah.
And that would include like management level field guys. Yep.
And what is your corporate structure kind of look like? I mean, obviously you're at the top, but then do you have branch managers over each division, or what do you look like there?
Yeah. So this has been a learning curve, and we had a lot of the org chart. I think as you get a little bigger, is one of the most important sales or important business tools, is to understand the organizational structure of your business. And to be really clear on it, and it evolves over time, but where we're at now, I feel really good with. So what we have now is we have a general manager, and then we have division managers for each sort of service line in the business. So we got a couple of guys overseeing maintenance and mowing. We got install manager, we got fertilization manager, a bed and bush guy, right? So there are these departmental managers that just manage a silo of service offerings. And each one of those departmental managers reports to the GM of the company. Then we have office type stuff, so administrative, that would be our office manager. She has a team and she reports to the general manager. And then the sales manager reports to the general manager. So it's one person at top with a top line of sales, operations, and admin, basically. Cool. And he calls the shots on everything. And so I'll give you an example of what an iteration we had that didn't work. Okay. So what we used to have was your divisional managers managing your mowing, your landscape, your fert. And then we had an operations manager, which is like the term everybody throws around. And he managed those divisional managers. And then he reported to the general manager at the top. So it's like an extra layer in there. But what we found is that there's obviously, the more layers you get, the more miscommunications happen. Mm-hmm. So what we landed on is general manager, who is the end all be all for operations, sales, and office. And his job, they can all communicate, but his job is to make the whole thing gel. And it's, if you drew it on a sheet of paper, it's a head at the top with a single line, no added bureaucracy.
Cool. And I'll have some questions on that. How many employees do you have total right now? I'm gonna guess like 50 some, right?
Yeah, somewhere in the 50s.
Cool. So how many layers deep does Chester go into the org chart for communication? How far down do you go? Like what layer?
I mean, I'll be out in the yard high-fiving guys. Yeah, I'm not like a four-hour work week guy. I freaking love this thing. I'm an 85-hour work week guy because I want to take over my region and, and dominate and kick ass and make a bunch of people on my team a lot of money. So I'll go out in the field and high-five guys, but you got to be really careful to not answer questions or give orders or really cast an opinion on what's going on. It's more like you're a cheerleader. But I would say that really my spot on the org chart is above the general manager. So he and I have a same page meeting. Yeah. He is the tiebreaker on everything. But I am occasionally involved with that top line of people, you know, that really report to Paul. I'm here every day and I'm talking to everybody and sort of just removing bottlenecks.
Yeah. Do you guys run EOS at all? Or you guys run the model?
Yeah.
Cool.
So in EOS terms, it's like integrator, visionary.
Yep.
Yeah.
Sweet. So how many meetings you guys typically have in a week?
We have a sales meeting. We have a leadership meeting. We have an admin meeting. These are all like L10s, right?
Yeah.
And then those divisional managers have an L10 with their crew, their team leaders, their foreman, whatever you want to call it. So there's a lot of meetings I sit in. I always sit in sales and I always sit in leadership. And then I usually have a save and page meeting with my integrator once, twice a month.
That's pretty awesome. So you said that you're trying to take over your region, trying to take over your county, which you've done that clearly. You have a ton of equipment. Do you have like a full-time mechanic that services everything? But I know your stuff's pretty new, so maybe you're not dealing with that kind of thing yet. But do you have a full-time mechanic on staff? And how do you handle the downtimes like that?
Yeah, we do. We have two. We have a daytime and a nighttime mechanic. We've been upgrading our fleet. And so I tell them my vision for you is not, dude, you know how it is back in the day. You're like swapping engines and like tie rods and crazy, you know, doing all kinds of dangerous crap. But now I tell those guys, I'm like, you become a fleet manager, like oil changes and tire rotations, right? We're not doing anything major. All our stuff's under warranty. And that's kind of the direction we're migrating the shop. Part of our business is like fleet management, PM, preventive maintenance type work.
That's really cool. For like your snow plows and your winter guys, are you subbing a lot of work in the snow side too? Or is it all in-house?
No, we maybe sub 20% of our revenue in snow.
Did you guys have a good winter?
We had a horrible winter.
It's horrible winter has too much snow. You're on contracts or not enough snow
and enough snow.
Gotcha.
And we're heavily contract based, so it wasn't a terrible thing, but we do a lot of, like our salt, most Saltings. Of our salt is per application anyway. So we just a really, really mild winter, but we got a really early start to the season. So we came out of the gate early and we're recovering from some of those losses, but we posted a loss for Q1.
Just because of the snow?
Didn't snow. Right. Yeah.
So would you change anything looking back at that of your model going forward for next year? Are you going to do anything different or just keep doing what you're doing?
No, I'm pretty confident in our model. The one thing we do have going now is we have a salt bin that can hold like 1,200 yards and we're selling bulk. And so I would probably be a little more proactive with marketing that and getting it out because we have people coming in and out here buying salt all night when it does snow. And it's a nice, we have it's like, if you build it, they will come. We have a loader and a bin and 1,000 tons of salt sitting there. It's like, there's no added overhead to sell it to other people. So I'm pretty bullish on building that piece of it.
I love that. That's cool. So Macomb County, was that, how many people are in Macomb County where you service? What's your service area? And I think, I feel like it's been growing and growing and growing.
It's growing. Yeah. The population density is growing. Our footprint isn't growing. If anything, if I could go back in time, I would have kept it so much smaller.
Really?
Yeah.
How far do you travel now?
I don't know, 20 miles, 15 miles maybe radius from center.
Right, but it takes you probably an hour to get there.
I'd say our for this accounts are probably in the 40-minute range.
Okay. Now with your technicians that are driving the far, do you guys pay hourly or are you paying like pay for performance type model?
Mowing, we're on P4P.
How do you handle the drive time like that?
Our mowing is pretty dense. We're typically not doing a whole lot of driving for mowing. And then I would say too that we still give them a pretty good route. So if you're going 40 minutes out, you're going 40 minutes out and you're working there all day.
Yeah.
So the guys make money. I mean, the guys make a ton of money on P4P and they love it and we love it.
That's really
cool. There is the occasional, you know, well, who got a better route? Or there's always like the woe is me type of stuff. But we got a pretty good squad. They get it.
And then on the FERT side, are you doing P4P on the FERT side too, or is it only mowing?
No, P4P is only on mowing.
Okay, cool.
Our FERT techs are hourly.
And then landscape crews, obviously hourly as well.
Mm-hmm. Landscape install is hourly.
When did you get into that? That feels like it's somewhat new, more install stuff. Like I feel like you're doing like hardscaping and installing lawns. Like it seems like maybe even last fall. Like I just started seeing you starting to do that. Is that newer?
It's newer. We did, for the past couple of years, we did like a million in landscape. And it was always just such a challenging division. And it's complex. It's hard to sell. It's hard to manage. You get it. Yeah. So I brought in a new manager and I said, dude, your sole focus in life is to just fix this landscape division. And you get 1 year, right? So if you fix it, we'll keep it. We'll run it. We'll build it. If you think it's unfixable, we will pivot and go in an entirely different direction. And I'll still keep you. Your job's not on the line because he was a solid guy. But I said, let's sink or swim this thing. You know what I mean? And he turned it around and did a really great job with it. And now it's running really well. And so we're building it. We're growing it. And then we're also subbing a lot of stuff too. So we're just trying to do a better job controlling the client relationship. And so that's where a lot of the patio and masonry work, brickwork and stuff, decks, is all coming into play because we can do a lot of it in-house, but we also have a really strong subcontractor network.
Gotcha.
And so we just want to control the market.
That's really cool. So you're selling the work and you're subbing out to someone else, probably getting the same margins, a little bit easier for you guys to operate too. But you have 50 people. Like, how are you? Like, are you guys struggling getting more people in? What's the recruiting venture look like down in the Detroit area?
It's this year. It seems like stuff has softened up a lot. I don't know about you, but it's been a lot easier to get people. And I've been hearing that across the country. And so right now we're staffed. We're a little over, we're a little heavy, but we're just, the sales team has gone in it trying to fill these, trying to feed these guys. So, it's been an easier hiring game this year, but we've experienced all the same challenges as everybody else. I mean, everything you can think of, you know. But what I believe, I have a few beliefs, but I think in general, the employee problem and the recruiting problem is like a belief system problem. Mm-hmm. Because I tell people this all the time, is like, go drive around your market. Go drive in any urban area or any area for that matter in the United States. The grass is cut. The trees are trimmed. The lawn is fertilized. Like the sprinklers are running. Well, who's doing it? Like somebody's doing it. If it was impossible to get people, then the nation's landscapes wouldn't be maintained. So while it's not easy, there's certainly people available. And then the other angle I have is like, yeah, okay, well, there's 100,000 people within 2 miles of our shop. And it's like, we need four. Okay. Yeah. Like, we need four out of 100,000. Like, can we do it? You know, so I think that it's become such a common thing to just say people don't want to work. And it's like, if people don't want to work for you.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's a belief system thing for me. So, and if you instill that into your team and you make them start to think about it that way, it seems like the recruiting thing gets a little easier.
Yeah. So are you having your guys recruit? Or do you have a recruiter? Are you doing it off Indeed, a recruiter? What are you guys doing to get people in for interviews?
Yeah, so we're running ads everywhere. So it's like office and administrative runs the ads and they're tasked with like lead flow, but then the division managers are the ones interviewing and hiring the people. So, you know, if you're this division manager, that top line guy, you're in charge of landscape. We'll feed you interviews, but you're the one that's going to schedule them, interview, vet the person, and plug them into your team.
Yeah. Do you have your guys hire on the spot, or do you follow up like the next day or two to give them the job? What does that look like?
I don't think we have that standardized. You know, I certainly think if you have somebody who's phenomenal come in, there's nothing wrong with offering them a job on the spot, you know, and sink your teeth into them. It's kind of like closing a sale, right? Like let's plug you in and make you feel like you have a job. But I don't think we have that a standard there.
Cool. What's the next 5 years? Like you guys talk about this all the time and I know the answer. Cause you have big dreams too, but what does the next 3 to 5 years look like for Big Lakes Lawn Care?
So our tentative plan right now, we got a lot of things going on. One though, is that I think when we go back to the conversation about org charts, I have been told, and it makes a lot of sense to me, that 5 to 7 million is like a real sweet spot in terms of your org chart. You can have one person at the top with a very clean system, and it's a good business to run. It's a sweet spot, right? So what we're doing is we're building this business to 7-8 million at this branch, and we're optimizing our margins. And then also on the side, I'm kind of vertically integrating some other parts of the business. So we're looking at our P&L going, where do we spend money? And like, where can we just own that business in-house? So for us, it's like a lot of bulk material stuff.
Yep.
Somewhere we got a real estate development going. So we're vertically integrating a lot of our cost structure in our P&L. We're building our business to about, we're going to build it as big as we can with a single person at the top. And then what we're going to do is start the branching model. So we're going to say, okay, we've written the book on how this business can run ridiculously efficient and profitable at the 7 to 8 million range. Now we're going to bite a chunk off and put a branch, just an operational branch, somewhere else right in our market with the same structure. We're going to build it to that same revenue model and let them compete and compare instead of having like one $15 million super branch. So that's kind of the next step, is to optimize our model here, which we're doing this year, branch it into a few different branches, strategic locations, all in the same market, take those all to 5 to 7. And then what I think we're going to do, and this might change, but I think we're going to do a partial recap where we sell a minority to like a private equity group,
yep,
get a huge ass check,
yep,
give all of my leadership team a huge ass check, you know, and then say, okay, now this private equity group is going to back us and we're going to go make strategic acquisitions throughout the region, the Midwest.
I love that.
Build that sucker up to 50 or 100 mil, sell it again, and see, you know, then from there, I don't know what the future holds.
How many years out are you thinking that's going to take you?
I think the recap will probably happen somewhere around like 2027 to 2030, or from like 4 to 7 years, depending on the market.
Yeah. And you're actually, I mean, you're in a great market down there too. It's like, there's, I don't know how many people in Detroit area, a million, maybe more.
I think there's probably a million in like the metro area. I think in our service area, there's maybe 650, 750, somewhere in there. But we're in a great market. We're not in, you know, phenomenal market, but we're in a stable market where people have some discretionary income and it's common to buy services.
Yeah. I think that I saw two different stats that just came to mind. Detroit was like number 15 on the most like dangerous cities. It actually dropped. It used to be higher to the top and now it's like in the middle somewhere. And then I saw another stat yesterday said something like 7 million people are at home not working because they choose not to. Don't ask me why I know these stupid things, but I just heard them yesterday or the day before. But
dude, those are provocative statistics, man.
And then yeah. Also, I know that Detroit's up there like on the top 50 rattiest cities in the country too.
Is it?
Yeah. So you get a lot of rat work.
all rattiest like
as union? Far as rats. Like actual like Norway rats.
Oh, like literally rats.
Yeah, literally rats.
Is it really?
Yeah.
Wow. See, I feel like when I go to New York or whatever, like there's.
I think
like,
New York's in the, like, the top five.
Yeah, that's where you Boston's just see them, there. Dude. Yeah, or Baltimore.
Yeah.
Yeah. In DC, a lot of places on the East Coast, but in Detroit, I'm not going to doubt it, but I don't see that many rats. Is there a business in rats?
Yeah.
There might be, maybe?
there's huge business in rats.
Really, dude?
Yeah. I have some friends that live down by you that are in pest control that are doing like 15 million.
Yeah.
And they're big.
That's sweet.
It's really cool.
Top 50 rattiest cities.
Yeah, Google it. I need my Jamie over here. Like, you should Google it. We're talking about it just to see if it's true or not.
I'll look it up.
Yeah, I don't doubt it one bit, dude. Like, hey, I thought you meant, so coming from construction, like, there's union workers, and then union workers refer to rat workers, like non-union workers. Gotcha. I'm like, where are we going with this, dude? I forgot. I should have known. You're talking about rats.
Yeah. What part of, like, when you're coming up to the business, like, what's the one thing that almost changed your mind about everything that you learned up until that point? Is there one person that you met that changed your life probably forever? Like, do you have like a mentor, couple mentors that that really changed your outlook on life and a lot of things?
Yeah, there's two. There's Jonathan Potoshnik.
Beast.
Dude, most special. Like,
how do we get so lucky? Like, that was my first mentor. How? Like, I feel like it's strictly luck.
Yeah. I don't know what else it could be, but that guy is just a very special person. And it's, you know, what do you say about the guy? He's just a class act in every way. He's so helpful. He just got me interested in business in so many ways that I didn't even realize were possible. Right. Just a great friend. Just a great, can't say enough good about that guy. And then the other one I'll say is Grant Cardone. When I started listening to his stuff just started drinking that Kool-Aid, I'm like, holy cow, man, he's also a very special person.
Yeah, for sure. And you go to a lot of the 10X conferences and stuff like that.
I do. Yeah. My team's on Cardone University and we, I pay attention to a lot of his stuff, listen to a lot of his stuff.
Yeah. I haven't been on Cardone U in probably like 3 or 4 years. Have they updated it at all?
It seems that way. Yeah. It seems like they're dropping new content and, you know, putting a lot of stuff into it.
Cause the last time that I was on it, it was probably stuff from early 90s. Maybe like it was old. So I was like, it's not really relative anymore, but I've heard yesterday actually again that someone texted me and said, hey, what do you think about this? I'm like, I've done it before. Like, his stuff's great, but it was really old. That's why I figured I'd ask. Like, have they updated a lot of the stuff?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they're always dropping new content in there, but we're still moving through like the basic Cardone U, right? Like the
overcoming objections. Curriculum. Yeah.
What's that?
Just overcoming objections in the office.
Yeah.
It's simple.
Yeah, man. Agree and acknowledge.
But it's so helpful.
It's so helpful. It's been super powerful for my team. Even I have like my CSRs and stuff on it. Everybody's on it. It's building their confidence. Right. It's been good.
How many sales guys do you have in your office?
One, two, like five.
Okay. Are they going out to the job sites like, and, you know, doing estimates and bringing them back? Like that kind of sales? Cool.
Yeah. If we're selling landscape, they're going to the site, meeting the client.
I don't know if you saw this posted yesterday, but someone asked in the group, they're struggling to have the handoff from the sales guys over to the install guys. They, even though they did a walkthrough, there's just there's notes, right? Some people said they put in a video, but what do you guys do to transition from, okay, sales guy made the estimate, he knows all the small little finite details. How do you pass that off the team to execute?
And have you found hard.
Yeah. Did you see that question post yesterday?
I didn't.
Okay.
It's hard, right? That was like one of the key pain points for our division for a long time is that, you know, there's details that get lost in translation or whatever. So for us now it's a meeting. The sales team meets with the project manager and the division manager once a week to talk about the upcoming schedule, what's going on. And then it's a communication thing. So if we're on like a multi-day job, the sales guy will come out, meet with the client, walk through and sort of you know, kind of bring them up to speed on what's going on and kind of resell the thing a little bit. But I would take this with a grain of salt, but what fixed that problem for us is when we got the right manager. We found out that it wasn't a process. And I found this to be true some time and time again, where it's not that you don't have the process or the SOP or you didn't train them or whatever. It's like, you just have the wrong person. So when we got that manager that I told you about, and I told him that the division was on the chopping block, right? Sink or swim. Once we plugged him in, we somehow those problems started to just dissolve because he just does a better job of managing the guys.
Yeah, that's smart. Mm-hmm. So you feel like that one key role fixed a lot of those problems?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, I think people they try to stick with the wrong person for too long. And I'm guilty too, right? I'm one of those guys too. I love people. I want to try to help them out, but at some point, it just comes to a point where okay, I should have known way faster. And then you get rid of that person instantly. The needle moves.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I feel like that's almost in every position.
Totally true. Yeah, and I'm guilty as charged. I mean, you see the best in people, and I think as an entrepreneur, you always see the upside,
right? So we're always
the best. You see how much they're capable of, but in the meantime, they're not performing and they're dragging things down, man. They're slowing things down.
Yeah, I agree. Let's switch over a little bit because we're running out of time, but I've got a couple of questions that I want to ask you. As far as marketing goes, I know you're pretty heavily doing marketing. Where have you seen the best ROI in your marketing dollars 2023?
Digital? Yeah, Google specifically.
Google Ads, Google LSAs. What's working best?
Yeah, I mean, LSA's cost to acquire is super cheap. Yeah. I don't have a lifetime value on that client yet, right?
Yeah.
Because that's where, it gets more sophisticated when it's like, first is cost per lead, then, okay, what's my cost per client? But then it's like, what's the LTV of that client? Yeah. To really find out my lifetime ROI on marketing dollars. LSA's, I think, are super promising because the cost is so cheap just to get clients. Mm-hmm. But lifetime ROI for us is Google AdWords.
Cool. Can you tell me what those things are, just for the new listeners, like LSA, that kind of thing?
It's just a local service ad. It's just a part of Google's. I don't know how many years ago, 4 or 5 years ago, they launched a new Google local service ad, so you can target more local people. And you have to go through a 6 to 8 month process to get guaranteed through there. You do background checks, you make sure you have insurance. You got to send pictures of your trucks getting wrapped. It's simple. It's a long process dealing with Google. And then every year you have to update it. So in the fertilization weed control side or pest control side, they make sure that you have your proper license every year. So every single year they go do audit. You have to update, and every year we get new license. We have to renew. So we have to update those, to update our insurance, things like that. The lifetime value of a client, just saying, okay, well, this client's worth $2,000. But on average, they're going to stay with us for 3 years, right? So technically, they're worth $6,000. So it's your lifetime value of that client. It's like $6,000, not the $2,000 that you got from your first initial charge of the marketing dollars. Let's say for lawn mowing, I'm going to guess it's somewhere between $50 to $75 for mowing. Right? I could be wrong. Chester, you can chime in there if you want. But I'd say, okay, this person costs $100 to sign up. They put on $2,000 revenue in year one, but then year two and year three, it's going to be an average of $6,000.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you're spot on.
I don't know where you're at as far as, and maybe you don't know either, but as far as where you're getting the cost per client for mowing right now.
Our global cost per client right now is in the 60s.
Oh, that's awesome.
Across all marketing channel, if I just took global marketing spend divided by clients acquired, yep, we're in the 60s.
That's awesome.
Yeah, it's good. It's really good.
Do you see them? I just feel, and again, I could be wrong too, because I'm not in the inside world like you are anymore with mowing. But if I was in a market like some of my friends, even you, I would have stayed in mowing for sure. Because the cost of acquiring clients so low, and there's a lot of people are getting out of it. Do you see the same thing, or is it just because I'm in a different world?
No, I think you're pretty spot on. I think a lot of people have.
I feel like it's just a home run.
What's that?
I just feel like it's a home run right now.
Mm-hmm. Oh yeah. And all the guys that do, there's so many FERT only companies, right? Well, yeah. Now if I do your mowing, you're going to come bring me your FERT too, because you want a single phone number. So that's how we fight True Green and whatever.
Yep. And it's kind of funny because like they always said like AI would take over like the blue collar jobs first, right? Like, yep, mm-hmm. these mowers are coming out and these drones are coming out. The blue collar jobs are the first ones done. Man has that reverse on us. So, hey, like ChatGPT and all this technology, like all the higher level people that you needed at the one point, like it's replacing those people that faster than it's replacing the blue collar community. It's like, I think our services are going to keep driving up, you know, as far as like price wise.
Totally agree. You know, I don't know. I certainly didn't recognize this when I got in the business. I don't know if you did. I was just like, oh, I used to cut grass. Now I'll go cut grass for my own company, right? But I mean, these businesses are scalable.
Yeah.
They're repeatable. There's a low barrier to entry.
Recurring revenue.
They're recession proof.
Yeah.
What's that?
Recurring revenue.
Recurring revenue model.
Something.
Yeah.
Sell it.
Not a very sophisticated competition. In your space, I think in pest control, the competition's a little more sophisticated and well-funded.
For sure.
But, you know, the average business, I mean, dude, these businesses have so much enterprise value. It's ripe for M&A. It's the most fragmented industry in the planet, right?
Yeah.
Like, it's like multi-$100 billion industry, and the average provider does like $400,000 a year.
Like, yeah. Yeah.
Crazy.
I agree with you. Yeah. But our goal, like, I think yours and mine both, is to up level our entire industry. Like, it's a $1 billion industry, but it's frowned upon against most people. Like, because like when people graduate high school, right, and they got to think like, okay, go get a girl or whatever, go get a guy. Like, you have to have a good career, right? And so they have to make the decision like, oh, do I want to go cut grass? Because it sounds like a shitty job, but if you can go out there and make $60,000-$80,000 a year in the blue collar world, like it's just one of those weird things, you know? Like, so if like people like yourself and myself like trying to up level our entire industry, so it's a badass industry to work in. Like, that's how we're going to get people in here. We just got to change that mindset, like you said earlier.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, totally agree with that. And I think people are coming around. You know, I think the college myth thing is becoming a little more widely appreciated, that you don't need to go to college to make money.
Yeah.
And like we talked about in the beginning, is like information is almost universally available and accessible. And so now it's not even about the information. So sure, like if you're going to be operating on somebody, right, or maybe defending somebody in court, whatever.
Your oh, for sure. If you're a lawyer,
it's like, there's like a base level requirement that I would personally like to hire somebody that has a degree or a license. But with a lot of these other things, it's the information is out there. You just got to go implement.
Yeah. If you're going to go be a lawyer, doctor, you know, something like that, obviously go to college for sure. Right. I don't want you guys just testing your, I don't know me. But like, yeah. Like there's a stat, like, I mean, I don't know what the stat is, but so many high schools are offering, like the apprenticeship programs, right? And they're teaching these kids the skills to go out there and add value to the workforce. I saw a stat yesterday, what I was getting back to, is that a journeyman plumber can make $270,000 a year. Not year one as an apprentice, but as a journeyman contractor, you can make $270,000 a year after about 5 years. So now...
Wow.
So let's just say you're going to college. Let's say you have $100,000 a year, right? So you go to school for 4 years. That's $400,000. Let's just pick. Maybe you're going to go be a CFO or an accountant and go make $100,000, right? Is it really worth it? I mean, you go be an accountant for, I'm going to say, $150,000, maybe $200,000, but you're $400,000 in debt, or you can. I mean, but then longevity, right? Like you said earlier, talking back to like your body just holding up too, right? Mm-hmm. So just all the things that kids have to think about these days. Like they can make a lot of money going to school and not going to school. But I wasn't going to go to school. I just wasn't that guy. I went for welding. Like a lot of people probably don't know that. I hated it. I absolutely hated it.
You're too impatient to be a welder.
Oh my gosh. It was bad. Too ADD to sit there and try to look at two pieces of metal for too long.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's a robot now.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah. No, you're spot on. It's an interesting world, man. And the opportunities are bigger, I think, bigger and more readily available than they have ever been before. And I think the ability to learn and to really implement
yeah.
and to get advice and, and admit when you don't know what you're doing is more powerful than a lot of stuff that you can learn in a traditional education.
For sure. The last topic, again, we got a few minutes left. Just talk about branding real quick. You're branded very well. You stand out amongst a lot of people. And all your trucks are all yellow. All your equipment's yellow. Got your bird, just something that's really cool. But people just don't realize how important your branding is. Like, it'll help you with your marketing. It helps with everything. It helps you with recruiting. Like, you know, you have 2, 3, 4 trucks that are bright yellow. People think you have 100, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. It's especially in businesses like ours that are so regionally dependent.
Yeah.
You know, our customer is around here, right? They're around us. So it has to be, the more recognizable you are, the better. And I didn't know any of this, like going into this stuff, which I'm sure you didn't either, nope. Right? I guess that's another comment on the whole traditional education thing versus like starting a business is, you know, if you just go, you just have to go try it, right? Like the business plan is a total procrastination tool. It's like, just go out there and do some stuff and figure it out and reiterate and try and fail and move along through the process. It's a process. And so branding, I'm sure for you now with your new venture, I think is pretty well thought out and sophisticated, and it's freaking brilliant. I think I love your stuff, but I'm sure in the beginning you're like, well, I'm just going to, hire some person I went to high school with to make me a logo, and
yeah,
you know,
I think back, like my old logo, like as a white truck with like this weird ass logo with my name on it, use my last name, like, you know, the shit that I shouldn't have done. But yeah, my new venture, I'm like, okay, this is all, like you said, it's thought out process, and yeah, it's awesome. I love it too. So thanks.
Well, dude, I could name my company Buchinski, right?
You could have, just no one knows how to pronounce it.
Yeah, we'd have 2 employees right now if I did that. But yeah, it's important. And it's like a thing that I kind of missed the mark on that my GM has been really pushy about is like the quality and cleanliness of our equipment and our uniforms, yes, and like our appearance.
Yes.
Right? Because brand is the whole presentation of what people think of when they hear your name. Right? And so for us now with leveling up our appearance of our property and our yard and our facility, like our location and our uniforms, we've invested in a whole new, way more sophisticated uniform, and just the whole presentation of how you show up,
yep,
how you park, how you carry yourself in a market like that. For businesses like ours that are regionally focused, it's critical that you just look a certain way.
God, right? I love that you brought that up. I don't think we've ever talked about that. And we did the same thing. We updated all of our uniforms from pants to shirts, everything, to gloves, like every single thing. And then, you know, we have a vehicle check once a week. They have to have everything in order. And then we make them wash their vehicles a minimum of 1 time a week, the inside and outside. Mm-hmm. And just take, you know, 10, 15 minutes, you know, and just clean it out. Every day, of course, they're supposed to clean it out. But, you know, for the most part, they do. We have really good people. But setting that expectation up front, saying, when you come to work here, this is how we operate. Like, we run a clean, efficient, that's how we want to present ourselves too, is money. So I'm glad you brought that up. Super good topic to talk about. Appreciate mm-hmm. that.
Yeah. Clean truck, clean job site.
Yeah.
Right.
I mean, you open up let's say you pull up to a job site, you open up the door and you have 800, Mountain Dew bottles falling over the place. It just looks bad. Mm-hmm. And it's the simple things like that set you apart from everyone else though.
Right. Right. And those simple things, can grow.
Yeah, it's a compound. Yeah.
Yeah, it's a culture of excellence, yep, right? It's just like, there was a book about it or something, Broken Windows, Broken Business, that whole thing.
Did you ever hear about that? No.
I don't know if it's a book. There's a book. I don't know if that's what the book is called, but the whole philosophy is Broken Windows, Broken Business. And it's a story about New York City in the 1980s. And it was like the most dangerous, crime-ridden, like prostitution city in the world, New York City. And I think Rudy Giuliani became the mayor.
Yeah.
And there was like a press conference. He won the election. What are you going to do first? And he said, I'm going to clean the graffiti on the subways. And they're like, dude, people are getting like murdered in broad daylight and you're going to clean up the graffiti. And he did. And then what that compounded into was, you know, now there's no graffiti on the subways. Now there's less trash, and there's less trash, then there's less likelihood that people are going to be drinking on there. And then there's less fights, which turn into less altercations and less people getting stabbed. it's like starting at the bottom and building it up that way is, it's like having a good foundation, you know? And so the person who, I think there's a book about it where they found out that like in cities where the windows are broken in a building, it's like 10 times more likely that you're going to get robbed or something. Wow. Because of how that goes together.
This is a totally just came to my mind, but, didn't you, sorry, this is the way my brain works. Didn't you mow the lawn for like Eminem's ex-wife?
She's selling the house.
So I was right. See, it's stupid things. Like, yep. I don't know why.
That's our client, dude. You're going to have to edit this out. Kim. Yeah, exactly.
That's pretty wild.
Someone associated with 8 Mile. We mow their lawn.
That's awesome.
House is on the market, man.
That's pretty wild. What? How much?
I think like $750.
Okay.
Yeah.
Right on. Last question for you, Chester. I know you're busy and you got to run. One piece of advice that you'd give all the entrepreneurs listening to this. Maybe two, but.
Dude, yeah, there's so many. One piece of advice I would give entrepreneurs. I would say, that what you say, let's put it this way. Whether you think you can or you think you can't, you're probably right.
Love that. You know? So true. This, I've said it a million times. This whole world's mindset.
Mm-hmm. Thoughts become things.
Yep.
You know? And what you say matters, and what you say to yourself and how you treat yourself and the thoughts going through your head every day matter, and they become your life.
God, you're a stud.
What's that?
Thank God you're a stud.
Yeah, dude. No, you're too kind, man. Yeah. He's in a pod, you and me.
For sure. Well, like I said, I told you that'd be the last question.
Detroit is the 9th rattiest city.
Oh, the 9th. See?
I know. It just moved down. Cleveland just went up 2 spots.
There you go.
You got to move to Cleveland next.
I was close. These are stupid things that I know in the back of my head. But again, Chester, thank you for your time. Thank you for your friendship. I appreciate you. I appreciate you being there for me in the past and vice versa, but you're a stud and thanks for being on the show.
Likewise, man. It's really cool you put this together and dude, much love. Yep, can't say enough good about you, man.
All right, buddy. Take care.
Person, entrepreneur, all around solid individual right here. Appreciate you, Jonas.
I appreciate you too.
Thanks for checking out another episode of the Pest Control Millionaire Podcast. If this was valuable to you, please leave us a review on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. It really makes a big difference for our growth. And if you do need any help growing your business, go ahead and check out pestcontrolmillionaire.com. We have lots of courses up there from sales to operations. I have some courses there about producing short form content. Plus, we have a mentorship program where you can get one-on-one business coaching from the Pest Control Millionaire himself. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you in the next one.